Yes, she was overweight, and yes, she had health challenges, including acute PTSD and depression. But the fact of the matter is that the racism, the trauma of the racism, the trauma of the everyday experience with racism and gendered racism, sexism and racism that affects Black women is clinically proven to age us.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, and you are listening to Into the Fold. The Hawk Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hog.utexas.edu, and as ever, HOG is spelled H-O-double-G. Health is not something that exists in a vacuum. As a foundation, we're driven by our conviction that a more just world is also a healthier one. That's one of the reasons why we talk so much about the social determinants of health. The World Health Organization defines social determinants as, and I quote, "the conditions in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age, and the wider set of forces and systems shaping the conditions of daily life." For Blacks in the United States, a key social determinant is the community impact of unequal policing. Its impact is profound, reaching down into the day-to-day life of neighborhoods, contributing to a toxic relationship between Blacks and police, and putting incredible strains on family life and people's health as well. Nowhere is this more apparent than in tragedies like the choking death of Eric Garner by New York police officers in 2015. It made headlines across the country, even at a time when it seemed every week brought a new story of a fatal encounter between an African-American citizen and law enforcement, Philando Castile, Michael Brown, and others. A chilling postscript to that story happened just a couple of months ago. Erica Garner, Eric Garner's daughter, died at the age of just 27 on December 30th, 2017. The Garner family name was again in the news, not just because of the father-daughter connection, but also the cause of death. Erica suffered a massive heart attack, which caused extensive brain damage. Our guest for this episode, Dr. Kristen Smith, is an associate professor of African and African diaspora studies and anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. She is not the first person to see a connection between Erica's death and the trauma of losing her dad. But a tweet that she sent out shortly after Erica's death led to a conversation that had been brewing for some time about inequality and health. A conversation that it seemed people were finally ready to have. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here and for this important program.
So I mentioned the tweet that you sent out after Erica's death. So why don't you share what it said and what it felt like to get the response that it generated?
Well, I think that it's important to contextualize the tweet in a broader trajectory as well. And so when I found out that Erica Garner had a heart attack, I sent out a tweet saying, basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, this is happening again. This is devastating. And I said it in that frame because I have been for several years looking at the adverse effects of police violence on the families of people who have been killed. And in doing that work, I have been seeing over and over again that in the wake of the killings of Black people by the police, oftentimes the mothers, the sisters, the daughters, the aunts, the family members, the girlfriends of people who have been killed are suffering devastating health effects. And most of those devastating health effects have a lot to do with the trauma and the depression that they feel as a result of the death of their loved ones. And so when I found out that Erica Garner had a massive heart attack, I just felt a rush of emotion because I knew that it was happening again. I knew that this was we were going through this again. And unbeknownst to me, I was tweeting about that, but unbeknownst to me, several people from New York who are close to Erica Garner were tweeting out another piece that I had previously written right after the death of Philando Castile on the effect of police violence on the affective communities of the dead, or the family members and the community members and the people who love them. And so that conversation really was born out of this conversation that I was having on Twitter, but then the conversation that family members and friends of Erica Garner were having about my work in response to her illness.
Yeah, so I first became a regular user of Twitter in 2007. I know that because on the day that I killed my account, just because I was curious,
right.
I felt that I needed to know how long I'd been on it. So that's a little over a decade of secondhand nonsense, and with the effects on my mental health to show for it.
Yes.
And at a certain point, I'd finally had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I've since, and well before then, I determined that, you know, that there's a pretty significant correlation between the amount of time that I'd been on Twitter and my own sense of wellness about
yes.
about myself and the world. Without getting too much into that, because there's mm-hmm. a lot that could be said mm-hmm. about how I use mm-hmm. you know, social, how we all do.
Mm-hmm.
So one positive effect, at least for Black people when it comes to Twitter, it is one effective transmission mode for the kind of call and response
yes.
that I think you're talking
absolutely.
About. And that, yes. and that we often use for coping with painful things that happen.
Yes, absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right. You know, social media is a blessing and a curse. But in moments of grieving for the Black community, particularly when you're talking about these violent moments of
yeah.
police killings, Twitter and Facebook have been collective spaces of mourning.
Right.
And they have been healing spaces. And part of the reason why I got involved in the Twitter conversation around Erica Garner's heart attack and her eventual death was because people were in pain. People were grieving. Her family was grieving. Her friends were grieving. And they were really, everyone was really struggling to try to figure out what was going on. And I was grieving, and I never met her personally. I was always a fan of her activist work. I always admired her because she was an amazingly honest person, and I just like spunky people, right? And so I always thought she was just a cool person. I always wanted to meet her. I never knew her, but I was devastated when I found out that she had this massive heart attack, and I was just overwhelmed with grief. And I turned to Twitter, like many others did, to just kind of come together and mourn and talk about our pain and talk about what we're going through, because this keeps happening. And, you know, we don't, it's a national problem, and there are very few national spaces where we can all come together and have a conversation, but social media is one of them. And so in many ways, we were holding a vigil trying to pray for her survival. And then when that unfortunately did not happen, we all came together and just mourned like a collective wake, a digital wake. And it was hurtful and it was painful, but it was also beautiful.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did you feel when you first found out about her death?
Oh, you know, I was devastated. That whole week was a really up and down week.
Yeah.
And so when I first found out about her heart attack, I felt it. I literally felt it. Like somebody punched me in the heart, to be really honest with you. I remember I was standing in my parents' kitchen because it was Christmas Eve. And I found out, and I felt like somebody just punched me in my gut. And it was just a pang of just hurt. And I remember crying. Because she was alive at that point, but there was something about the tone of the news that just didn't feel like it was going to end well to me. And I spent the next week just kind of, we were all of us that were following it, we were all just kind of like on pins and needles, like what's happening.
Yeah.
And then of course the New York Daily News reported that she was brain dead before her family was ready for her to let her go.
Right.
And that was hard. And when they reported it, a lot of us, including myself, assumed, erroneously so, that that was information that was already corroborated and confirmed. And I remember when I heard that, I just cried and 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 cried. And then there was this emotional roller coaster where her family said, no, 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 she's still alive. Don't say she's dead.
Yeah.
But that was already this harbinger of what was to come. And so by the time she actually passed away, we all had been grieving for a while, I think. But it was just devastating. It was just devastating. I mean, I can't use another word. It was heartbreaking, especially since, you know, she had her son at the time, her newborn was 4 months old. Right. And so the heart condition that she had that caused her heart attack was an enlarged heart that was precipitated by her pregnancy.
Yeah.
Which, as we know, if you follow information, the recent research on Black women's and health, or Black women and health, particularly recent research articles that have been published about this issue, is that one of the reasons why Black women have such adverse health experiences in pregnancy is because of the stress of racism. And so it's the weathering, what they call weathering. It's the biological breakdown on our bodies that racism produces that literally makes us older than we are and also makes our pregnancies and our health position more precarious. And so, you know, when everybody found out about her heart attack, there were some really nasty people. Like, you're talking about Twitter and how nasty it can be. There was some nasty people on Twitter who were saying things like, well, of course she had a heart attack. She was fat. Of course she had a heart attack. She didn't take care of herself. Blah, blah, blah. Beside that just being just gross behavior, given the context, the fact of the matter is it's just not accurate. So yes, she was overweight, and yes, she had health challenges, including acute PTSD and depression, right? But the fact of the matter is that the racism, the trauma of the racism, the trauma of the everyday experience with racism and gendered racism, sexism and racism that affects Black women is clinically proven to age us. And so it is clinically proven to break down our bodies. It is clinically proven to actually precipitate our premature deaths. And so as much as we want to turn to all of these very easy and convenient excuses as to why a 27-year-old might have a heart attack, we cannot avoid the conversation about the ways that her father's death and racism factored into this.
Yeah. So, I mean, you likened it to being punched in the heart.
Yeah.
So your heart, her heart, my heart. So, I mean, you know, and you can talk all you want about your social determinants. Mm-hmm. 27-year-old ain't supposed to die
exactly
of a heart attack.
Exactly.
And as much as anything else, her age is what stops me cold.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm of an age now where I'm worrying more about my cardiovascular health.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I think about my heart, which I try not to do too often.
Right.
I don't know. It always shows up in my mind as this sort of merciless timekeeper.
Mm.
But that also seems to shorten time
mm-hmm.
while it runs, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, but the conclusion for me is inescapable, that our hearts carry as much of the extra load of inequality as our minds do.
Yes.
And yes, you know, she was overweight according to most standard definitions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing that I've come to appreciate, only more so because of things like this, is that our bodies are not impermeable.
Mm, absolutely.
It's just one, another of those things that ought to prompt our deeper questioning about how all of these different structures literally reach down into us.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So that never feels like a good enough rejoinder to the nasty people on Twitter who you're talking about. But I don't think it's any less true for that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I mentioned those kind of nasty, evil comments because I think it's important for us to recognize that even in sickness and in death, people are not able to really feel and empathize with Black women's pain. And that is something that I think that we need to really come to a reckoning on as a community here in the United States and probably globally. It's like there's a young woman who's 27, who's a new mother, who has a 4-month-old at home, and your first thought is to criticize her on her weight when she has a massive heart attack? What is that? Right? What kind of world are we living in?
Yeah.
If that's the response that people are that people immediately go to. And I think that it really is reflective of some of the deeply divisive kind of social challenges that we're facing right now.
Or another of the different ways we have of pathologizing Black bodies.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Your tweet then led to a full-blown piece that you got published in The Conversation. And so here's a quote. Erica knew that the aftershocks of her father's death were killing her slowly. This is what in part makes her death so painful. The fallout of police violence, not just the chokeholds and baton blows, are killing Black women. If the world is to truly begin to take steps to preserve Black women's lives, then we must take this into account in our discussions. So I want to focus in on the first two words. Erica knew.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what do you think Erica herself had to say about the connections between what happened to her father and her health struggles?
Well, there were a couple of interviews that she did before she died.
Yeah.
The first one was on Democracy Now! A few months ago. And the second one was the last interview that she did before she died. That was on a popular radio program. And in both of those interviews, she says clearly, my father's death and all of the pain that I am still dealing with as a result of the traumatic way that my father was killed is taking a toll on me mentally. It is taking a toll on me physically. And literally in her last interview, she said, you know, this whole thing, it breaks you down. It breaks you down. Look at Vanita Browder. Look at Khalif's mom. It killed her. She knew, and what she's talking about is Khalif Browder's mother. Khalif Browder was the young man who committed suicide after being confined in Rikers Island prison and tortured and put into solitary confinement for 3 years of his life, and then being let out and not having the mental stability to be able to deal with life after that, and understandably so. And he committed suicide in his mother's house. And 6 or 7 months later, his mother died of a heart attack. And so the fact that Erica Garner would invoke Vanita Browder in talking about herself, that's what I mean when she said she knew. She knew it was killing her. She could feel it. She was crying out for help and nobody was listening. Actually, no, her family was listening. Her friends were listening. But as a society, as a collective community, we weren't listening.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a chilling thought. You know, I mean, if Erica ever suspected that the shock of her father's death could, you know, could hasten her own demise.
Mm-hmm. I think she definitely suspected that. Yeah. I think none of us really ever want to come to grips with the possibility of our own deaths.
Yeah.
But I promise you, in that last interview, if you look at it and you listen to it, there's a deep pain and a deep sadness on her face. And she said, it's breaking me down. I mean, she's literally crying for help. She's like, this is breaking me down. This thing is breaking me down. And it's you can feel the way that she was in pain. She was in pain. And that doesn't mean that, oh, well, she knew what was going to happen, so she should have sought out help. One of the things that she talks about is the fact that given the economic situation of her family, it was very difficult for her to get counseling. Because nobody ever thinks about the fact that these families need counseling, and they're mostly working class families. They're families on public assistance. And so who's going to pay for that? In that same interview or it's the interview from Democracy Now. I can't remember which one it was. I'm sorry about that. But in one of the interviews that she did, she mentions her young niece and the fact that her young niece is having behavioral problems in school. And part of the reason why she's been having behavioral problems in school is that she hasn't been able to come to grips with her grandfather's death. And they haven't had the money to be able to get the child counseling. So at what point do we begin to see this as a social issue? At what point do we say this is a mental health issue that is one that is killing people, is harming communities, and that we have a collective responsibility in order to deal with it? We always want to talk about the collective responsibility of public security, and we want to support this question of needing public security. But what about when the state does things that hurt people? Right. How are we going to respond to that? And she was hurting.
So notwithstanding all of the nasty people on Twitter, I think that there is an understandable inclination to see Erica's death so soon after her father's as a coincidence. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily as something that implicates the system or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, she did have an enlarged heart after all. So mm-hmm. So what's, I guess, a sincere response to or way of engaging those whose natural inclination might be to medicalize what happened to Erica?
Mm-hmm. I think that my sincere response to that is that even if we take into account her health challenges and all of the factors, the adverse factors that could have potentially contributed to her premature death, we cannot rule out the distinct possibility that the trauma of her father's death took a physical toll on her body. There is enough research in public health, in biology, in medical research on Black women to say that racism and the experience of the stress of racism takes a physical toll. And so I would say to those people who may be wondering if this is possible, take a look at the research that's out there on Black women and stress and racism and weathering in particular. And that's the actual term that's used, weathering. And one of the things that you will find is that this is a pervasive issue, one that affects Black women across the board, even if they're not in these traumatic situations. And so when you have somebody in a situation of extreme trauma like this, then that just exacerbates it. And I think particularly the article from ProPublica that was published just a few weeks before Erica passed away about literally the title of the article is "Nothing Can Save Black Women from Premature Death Related to Pregnancy." I'm paraphrasing, but that was the fact that nothing can save Black women was definitely in the title. And literally what the article does is go through the litany of scholarly research on this issue and shows without a shadow of the doubt that even when Black women die of things like an enlarged heart related to pregnancy, which was Erica's situation, that we cannot dissociate that process from the processes of racism that lead to the weathering that make it such that that kind of condition will affect a Black woman more than it affects a non-Black woman.
Right. And tying this to what the Hogg Foundation is doing, one reason I'm excited about our new strategic direction is that it gives us warrant to jump on these kinds of teachable moments where we can get really specific about what it is that we mean by social determinants. And for me, I mean, making this understanding front and center does not eclipse individual effort. If anything, it clarifies where and when it can be most effective and the reasons why.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that it's becoming more and more apparent that when we talk about these questions of health and particularly mental health, that we have got to look at the social contexts that produce certain kinds of experiences for people. And that's directly tied to social determinants. And unfortunately, in the world that we are living in right now, police violence is a social determinant.
Yeah, it is. And do you ever feel that as a Black woman, that some aspect of your own mental health is at stake in stories like this? I mean, you clearly felt something in response to what happened to Erica. I think that we all did. And solidarity, it entails a level of emotional exposure and vulnerability that can be exhausting. So is that something you think about? And if so, you know, how do you protect your own mental health?
Absolutely. I absolutely think about this, you know.
But also as someone who's called upon to have opinions on this.
It's very true. No, definitely. And I think that this is something I think about a lot. My research generally is about the impact of police violence on Black communities in the United States and Brazil. From a transnational perspective, the Americas generally, but particularly the United States and Brazil. And so I'm dealing with these stories constantly. So it's Erica's story, but it's also the 20, 30 other stories that I know from my everyday research and also from my experience kind of working with communities around these issues. And so it takes a toll. It definitely takes a toll. And I think that self-care is really important. But like most Black women who are dealing with something that we see to be an issue of social justice, I could do better because there are moments when this really does break me down. There are moments when I can feel the weight of despair from all of the stories that I read about all of the young kids that are killed, about all of the mothers that are suffering. And then the fact that I speak out on this issue and I try to be an advocate for families and an advocate for people who have been the victims of police violence, then what ends up happening too is that everything that happens that's wretched, people send to me. And so, you know, I'm thinking about particularly the story of the young woman whose baby was killed, the one-year-old baby was killed recently in a car crash with a police officer who was driving erratically, and then she was charged with manslaughter. We have to factor that story into this particular situation as well. And so these things are constant. And so it's not just about taking care of ourselves after one story. These things don't stop and they keep coming. And I think that it's a constant struggle for those of us that are Black women, particularly those of us that work on social justice issues. It's a constant struggle to take care of ourselves because we're constantly in a state of grieving. That's why Claudia Rankine talks about the fact that to be Black in America is to be in a constant state of mourning. And that's how we feel. That's how I feel. I feel like I'm in a constant state of mourning.
Yeah.
And it's emotionally and psychologically really, really painful and difficult to deal with.
Yeah. And to bite off a piece of that, one other benefit of getting older is that I get more reflective on the whole business of being a Black guy with opinions. Mm. And how exhausting that gets. And that's without even taking into account the secondhand trauma of being saturated with media images of Black suffering and death.
Yes.
And I'm at a point now where I feel like I'm just past my heyday of needing to have sharp, quick takes on everything. Mm-hmm. That's at this point, something more than just carrying the banner for the correctness of my opinions is called for. Mm-hmm. Maybe more action, maybe more of a different kind of action. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of jives with what you said.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that we're at a critical point in our history where talking is just not enough. I think that we're at a point when there has to be action.
Yeah.
Because there is something mind-numbing about constantly saying the same thing over and over again because these things keep happening. And I think that's part of what's really a challenge. It's like we're not only speaking out on these issues, but we speak out on these issues and we talk about the way that we need to address it. We talk about the things that need to happen, and then they keep happening again in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. And so we need to take this conversation to another level. It has to be coupled with action, because if it's not coupled with action, then we're literally just speaking in a vacuum, and we're going to go insane, because we're going to keep talking about the same thing over and over again, and nobody's going to be listening, and everything's going to keep happening. And so what do we then do about it? I think that that's an absolutely important thing to try to consider. And I think that that's something, but it's also challenging, right? Because of what you just said around mental health and advocacy, you know, the fact of the matter is sometimes you don't want to get up and do anything because you're tired. And I think that that's real. And I think that that's why these conversations have to happen in community. We can't do anything individually, because one person can't carry a fight. One person can't carry a struggle. We have to struggle in community, because that way, when somebody gets tired, when somebody needs a break, then somebody else is there to pick it up.
Yeah. That was part one of our conversation with Kristen Smith about police violence and its effect on Black women's health. For part two, we open up the conversation to talk a bit more generally about race and inequality, with a focus on the Hogg Foundation's home city of Austin, Texas. Please check it out and let us know what you think. Thanks for joining us.